Tim. Remember, your records must be 2:30 and bright. A 23-year-old kid deciding what 14 million people will listen to in the mornings. I can't imagine any other life that would have been any more exciting.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Tim Blackmore.
I remember one night my parents went out when we lived in Stoke-on-Trent, and I wanted to hear Journey into Space, and I put it on, but I had to turn it off before the end because I was so frightened. I mean, that was the compelling power of radio that got to me then.
3, 2, 1, contact!
My parents, who were not at all rich, had put the pennies together and bought a single play record player. And they gave me two records that Christmas 1957. One was Paul Anka's Diana. The second, which I think was bought more for them than for me, was Harry Belafonte's Mary's Boy Child, which I wasn't that keen on.
Pops a plenty in top 20.
So that was the era of Luxembourg. In the evenings, I listened to our little Decca valve radio. It was the same radio that I well remember hearing the news of the Munich air crash with Manchester United. I was sitting halfway up the staircase with the radio on a long lead down to me, listening all the time to the radio to find out whether people like Duncan Edwards and Bobby Charlton had survived or not. An incredible moment. But that whole era was evenings listening to the radio, because as a million people will have told you, we could only hear contemporary pop music in any consistent way by tuning into Radio Luxembourg. The Light programme did play some of the rock and roll records as they came through, but it would have been perhaps 10% of the content of any record-based programme. The rest of the music would be the more traditional music that had existed up until the mid-50s, the big bands, the crooners, the Frank Sinatras.
So we'd like to tie in one more quick dedication from all the purple people eaters of Form 4A, Clifton Hall, Nottingham. Here we go, Who Put the Bomb?
I'd like to thank the guy.
After we left Yorkshire, this was in the summer of 58, we moved to a little town in the northeast of England called Blyth. In those days, it had 2 shipyards and 5 mines. Now it has none of them. My father was a Methodist minister, clergyman, and he set up in that town, soon after we arrived, a youth club. And we met on Friday nights, with occasional dances on Saturday nights. And I had brought my single-play record player connected to a little amplifier that I'd built out of a magazine called Practical Electronics or something, and a 12-inch speaker that I put into its own cabinet. So I started to understand something about microphones, record players. By 1960, everybody in the youth club had got fed up with the fact that we had this gap when people were dancing, for when one record ended, until you could get it off the turntable, lift the arm off, put the next record on, put the arm back on, and it was a problem. So we raised a whole load of money, and we built what I think must have been the first twin turntable unit in Northumberland. The concept of mixing hadn't even been invented. But there we were able to provide non-stop music for the dancing sections of the youth club activities. Similarly, in the sixth form at school, I was writing and producing for the Drama Society and our end-of-term reviews, lots of silly sketches, joke news, the things that everybody does. And so by the time we got to the end of the sixth form, and I had to take my A-level examinations, I had not devoted as much time as I should have done to the magical worlds of pure maths, applied maths, and physics. The end result was I think I got 35% and 25% in 2 of them. I'd got 3 places to study electronics at university, but my father, with some kind of, maybe it was religious perception, feared that I might not have done as well as he would have liked, and had suggested that I apply for jobs. I went for an interview with EMI at their Hayes factory in Middlesex. And it was all going swimmingly until they asked me how I felt about working in their electronics division, which I was quite excited about. And they said, well, you do understand that our main thrust is our guided missile systems. And I said, oh, well, that's a bit embarrassing. I said, because I'm the honorary secretary of the local CND group. And that thus ended my EMI interview and the chances of my ever having gone on and signed the Beatles later. The BBC, however, were true gentlemen, and I had an interview with them. They said, well, although we're disappointed with your exam results, your interview was encouraging, and we'd like to offer you a job as a trainee technical operator. The end result of that was on September the 22nd, which was a Saturday, 1962, I left home with my big white suitcase and arrived in London.
I'm just a baby.
On the Monday, I reported to Broadcasting House and began, as I recall, a three-month foundation training course for BBC technicians. And then another 3 months of probation, and at the end of the first year, I was declared a qualified technical operator. Now, in those days, there were very strict divisions between the people who worked in different parts of the BBC. As a technical operator, I wasn't really allowed into a studio unless it was to operate a tape machine, because studios were the preserve of the studio managers, the SMs, the elite of the programme operations system. My jobs were to record programmes principally, or to switch programmes from one source to another destination. Now it's all done electronically with the help of a variety of styles of computer. But in those days, we had a lot of jack plugs, double enders we used to call them. And we would pick up the output from one studio and plug it into the feed to a transmitter somewhere else. And then also we operated as engineers the continuity studios, where the announcers would link from a programme coming from Studio S4 to an outside broadcast coming from Wembley or whatever it might be, and we ran all those. It's interesting to recall, 1962, to me that doesn't seem that long ago, but we didn't have very many tape recorders. We had some EMI TR-90s, we had some EMI BTR-1s and 2s, but the bulk of what I recorded initially was straight onto disc. We were cutting acetates, steel discs, normally of 12 inches or more diameter, covered in shellac, into which the needle would cut the recording that you were making. If it was a talk of 2.5 to 3 minutes, there was no problem, because the disc would contain that easily. I remember on one occasion where I had to record and instantly broadcast, I think it was the Derby. Now, the Derby began on the hour at 3 o'clock. But the problem was we had a news bulletin that started on the hour at 3 o'clock and lasted for 8 minutes. So I started recording the horse race commentary on the hour as it began. And before it had finished at 8 or 9 minutes past the hour, I had to start broadcasting when I was still cutting discs for the tail end of the race. But each disc would only run for 3 minutes. So what you did was when you got towards the last 20 seconds or so of one disc, you'd start recording on the second disc. So therefore, the last bit of the first disc was identical audio to the first bit of the second disc. And when it came to broadcast it back out, when you realised you were getting into the last 20 seconds of the first disc, you'd start the second, listening on headphones, spinning it manually to get it to exactly the same point in sync with the first, then flick the volume controls, the faders, and it would sound like a continuous broadcast.
With a furlong to run, it's Indiana that comes to the front from Dilettanti with Santa Claus challenging on the stand side. It is Indiana.
It was incredibly gentlemanly. The studio maintenance engineers, for instance, wore white coats, long white coats. The studio attendants, who were the people who refilled the jugs of water and emptied the waste bins, they wore long brown coats. I wouldn't say the announcers still wore evening jackets at that point. That had gone. But certainly, everybody, including we, the technicians, we certainly wore suits, collars and ties, and it would have been unthinkable that you would have dressed in any other way.
This is BBC One.
Television was starting to be seen as more important. There was a feeling that we weren't getting the investment. There was a feeling that television was making the running. There was already talk about the upcoming colour television, the upcoming expansion of new channels. So radio was really right on the back burner. And I don't believe that the BBC began to reinvest in radio until they saw the threat of commercial radio coming around the corner. I lasted as a technical operator until 1965. And I had then sussed that the studio managers were having much more fun in the studios than I was in the continuity suites or the recording channels, as they were called. Applied, did my training course as an SM, and acted as an SM at Bush House. I was allowed to make opening announcements for various services. You're tuned to London in the World Service of the BBC. Commentary after the news will be by Dr. David Lloyd on the influence of Charles Dickens in English literature. This is London.
This is the BBC World Service.
Interesting thing about voices, because once you'd done your SM training, you then had a voice evaluation. And I was given what was referred to as a 1B voice. And the distinction was that a 1A was allowed to do everything and read the news. A 1B was allowed to do everything but not read the news. And that was a body blow, because I thought reading the news at that point was the most exciting thing that anybody, you know, that was the peak. If you could read the news on the BBC, that was close to heaven. Before you get to announce, to broadcast, you think that broadcasting is fantastic. I have to tell you, by the time you've done your second night shift, speaking once every 30 minutes, you don't want to do it anymore. And that was the point where I knew I didn't really want to be a broadcaster. I mean, ironically, I did start to do broadcasting later on. But at that point, I thought it was just the dullest thing ever. And to me, the people who were having fun were the people who were putting the programmes together.
The current Caroline temperature check is 7 degrees centigrade. That's 45 degrees Fahrenheit.
This has been Caroline Newsbeat.
What had happened by the summer of 1967 was that the Labour government had decided that the activities of the pirates was not to be tolerated anymore. Because they were, by and large, in international waters, there was not a lot the government could do because it wasn't illegal. What they decided to do was to make it illegal to supply the pirate broadcasters with anything. Records, food, elastoplasts, you name it.
Big old time is 3 o'clock and Radio London is now closing down.
But by then the government had realised that there was a massive demand, there was a massive market. And they started to put pressure on the BBC to set up another radio station that could meet the demands of that market after the pirates had gone. The BBC initially denied that there were any frequencies available and fought tooth and nail against having to make any concessions to allow it to happen. But in the end, Wedgwood actually started the ball rolling, but then it was Edward Short who put into practice the implications of what became known as the Marine Offences Bill and persuaded the BBC they had to do something. The end result was they created a new structure. Essentially, they split the light programme that had existed into radios 1 and 2. The third programme continued as Radio 3. The home service, well, you've got 1, 2, 3, so it'll have to be number 4.
Oh, two for the price of one. That's the BBC's aim with the introduction of radios 1 and 2. On Radio 1, it's pop for the swingers. On Radio 2, many of the new shows, along with the regular light programme favourites. September the 30th is bargain day on radios 1 and 2.
And that summer, they advertised jobs for young people to help launch the new network. I was employed to work on the new breakfast show. So I came in and met a young man called Tony Blackburn, who was a year older than me. And for the first, I think it was first 5 weeks, the music on the breakfast show was chosen by Johnny Beerling, the exec producer. And then I was given my head on it. I have over there the playlists for the first few years of the breakfast show, because in those days I introduced the first playlist that the BBC had. There was no station playlist, but Tony explained to me in detail what they'd done on Radio London with a 40, and he showed me the format for the rotations. I didn't know anything about formats, rotations or playlists, but it all seemed to make a great deal of sense. So I'd introduced the idea of a playlist and a format, and that's what we did. And from 1967 through till about 1970, I produced the Tony Blackburn Breakfast Show.
Actually, as is my first day with the BBC, nobody knows I'm in the building yet, because I thought, as is my first day, I won't push my luck. So I entered by the tradesman's entrance.
If you're going to San Francisco.
It would be difficult to overestimate the level of excitement being in London in 1967. London, as we say rather cynically now, was swinging and then some. And here was Tony and me. Tony was 24, I was 23. We were being sent every week all the single record releases to listen to and to play the ones we wanted. There were no edicts from on high. I was never told at any point what I should be including in that programme. It was my personal judgment. A 23-year-old kid deciding what 14 million people will listen to in the mornings. Not only was I getting free records from the record companies, do you know, Tony and I were invited to premieres of films. We had free tickets to go and see all our favourite acts. It was a world to be dreamt about for young people in the 1960s. We loved every minute of it. I can't imagine any other life that would have been any more exciting or any more challenging than that which we experienced at that point in history.
Number 15 this week in the Fun 30 from Radio 1. It's called Massachusetts, and of course it comes from the Bee Gees. I'll tell you what, I want you particularly to look upon the show as your own. If you've got anybody you want to say hello to before you go to work in the morning, then this is all you have to do.
I would, over probably 2 days, choose all the music for the 5 shows of the next week. Because I had to listen to every new record that came out. And in those days, it was anything from 80 to 120 singles a week. Plus, I would listen to albums because our format allowed for one album track an hour. Quite literally, the only other thing we prepared would be the competitions that ran. And that was it. Everything else that Tony uttered came out of Tony's head. He used to have these red exercise books that he carried with him at all. And whenever anybody said anything funny to him or told him a joke, he would write it down. So he had, and by the end of the first 3 years when I left, I mean, he had a pile of these things. He had to carry them in a case. The jocks in those days on Radio 1 really prepared their own material. And some were very good, some were lazy, some didn't bother at all and just turned up and hoped that something dropped into their head as they did it. So in the summer of 68, 69 and 70, I was relieved of my breakfast show responsibilities. And I used to produce all the other shows for 2 weeks at a time as the producers went on holiday. I worked on the early Radio 1 clubs, travelling round the United Kingdom, producing shows from discos and ballrooms in virtually every town there was. That was a phenomenal experience. And later I went on to end up being the guy in charge of the Radio 1 roadshow and travelled the country every summer for many, many years. The big change came in 1971 when I was moved off the breakfast show permanently. Kenny Everett, much beloved of this parish, was fired from his job with the BBC. People often say it was because he made an allusion that the Ministry of Transport's wife had passed her driving test because she was married to the... In fact, technically, that wasn't the case. Kenny was actually fired because he had given a previous undertaking not to speak to the press. And he had chosen to speak to the press. So that was the technical reason why he was got rid of.
Jenny Pascoe, she crammed a fibre in his hand. I know these people.
Kenny was a difficult man to work with, to get on. He had his friends, but if you weren't in his inner circle, I found he had difficulty making eye contact. He certainly preferred working at home to working in the Beeb. Next to my office was an office for a producer called Aidan Day, and next to Aidan's office was what we called the Wireless Workshop, which we built for Kenny. It had a little four-channel mixer with rotary knobs, it had 3 tape machines, a voice coder, what I can't remember what it was called at the time, and he would go in there and work, but he did most of his work at home, where he had his own setup built. He was incredibly creative, but personally very, very challenged. He had difficulties, I think, dealing with people. In later years, after I had left Capital Radio, I was asked by the BBC to go in and work with them on a series called Radio Radio of interviews with jocks. And apart from doing the research, I conducted the interviews with all the jocks. The only person in that series who refused to be interviewed by me was Kenny Everett. And when I asked a friend of his, a guy called Eddie Puma, to go and find out from Kenny why he wouldn't talk to me, the message came back, you were the only person at Capital who ever gave him a bollocking. He was a complex man, and as is the way with so many people of genius.
Ever since my sacking in 1970, by the way, what do you think of my sacking?
Oh, it suits you, darling.
Having got rid of him, they put Noel Edmonds in his place. Now, the day that happened, I was producing Noel Edmonds on a Radio 1 roadshow, or was it a Radio 1 club? It must have been a Radio 1 club. And after the show was over, there was a phone call to say that Mark White, who was then the head of, who's head of Radio 1, I think, at that point, had wanted to talk to Noel. And Noel came back to me and said, oh, they want me to take over from Kenny Everett on Saturdays. What should I do? So I think the answer is you say yes, because if you say no, you won't be getting any more offers. So Noel got given that Saturday morning show and I was allocated to be his producer. They took me off and gave me to Noel. From then until October, we produced the Saturday morning programme for 2 hours, but it wasn't going well. There was a great deal of resentment in the audience that Kenny had gone, and totally illogically, a lot of this passed on to Noel and people were saying, you know, we don't want him, we want our Kenny back. Noel, as a great admirer of Kenny, found very difficult to handle, but had to live with it. And then in October, for reasons that I can't remember now, Noel was moved from Saturdays to Sundays. He was really cross about that because he felt we were starting to make a mark and we were building. And you know, anybody listening to this will know that you don't want that much change in a radio. Audiences are quite creatures of habit and they don't like change. But we were moved to Sundays. And I thought about this long and hard. And I said, I think what we need to do is do something that is so different from anything that's been here before that it will set you apart. And Noel said, well, yeah, what's it going to be? I said, well, I think the most significant thing that's happening musically at the moment, we're talking now 1971, I think, I said, is the emergence of the singer-songwriters. You know, Elton John had just had his first album. Cat Stevens had left Decca, had tuberculosis, signed to Ireland, had brought out Mona Bona Jaycon. Neil Diamond had given up being a professional songwriter and was now performing his own songs. There was a whole wave. And I thought that if we devoted Sunday mornings to that kind of music, we would create a very identifiable Sunday morning sound. And we did it. And I remember having a debate about what we were doing at a BBC meeting where one executive producer said, Tim, we're all about one thing on this station. Remember, your records must be 2:30 and bright. For anybody who didn't get that, that's 2 minutes and 30 seconds duration, and they must be up-tempo. Of course, when I was choosing singer-songwriter tracks for this programme, very few were less than 3.5 minutes, and quite a lot of them were very thoughtful and slow. Anyway, we stuck with it because the executive producer, a man called Teddy Warwick, decided, yes, you're doing something different. Let's stick with it, see what happens. And after 3 months, the Sunday morning audience programmes were up 13%. And we created what I think became known as that Sunday morning sound. We also developed the use of humour on radio in Sunday mornings. So that Sunday morning show was phenomenal.
Yeah, we've got an album track now from Simon and Garfunkel, not Bridge Over Troubled Water, nay. This is Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme. I don't know. It's a Scarborough Fair canticle. Canticle, actually. You know, if you get it under one arm, it really is.
Well, I was producing Noel on Sundays. I was also producing a man called Stuart Henry on Saturdays. And Stuart was one of the loveliest men ever to occupy this planet. We broke a few boundaries there and quite a few rules because Stuart cared about the environment. We used to cover all sorts of stories about how detergents being leaking into rivers were causing the growth of plankton and creating all sorts of difficulties. Time and again, I would go and have to apologise to a trade association or a manufacturer or whatever. Stuart cared about people who had run away from home. Working with Stuart was terrific as well.
Stuart Henry.
Help me. All right, lads, a wee blast then.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. The weekend, baby, is starting right here.
But then one day, I was called into Derek Chinnery's office, and Derek said, Douglas Muggeridge, the controller of 1 and 2, has decided that it is time for the BBC's pop music network to demonstrate that it can make a real radio programme. And we are going to broadcast 26 one-hours telling the story of the last 20 years of the emergence of music from 1954 through till 74 when it'll be broadcast. And we think you're the person to put this together.
The story of pop.
Well, at this point in time, I'd never interviewed anybody. I'd not written a proper radio script. I'd written links for jocks, you know, which is hardly in the same league. And I didn't think I knew anything like enough about the history. So I went back in the next day and I said, yes, OK, I'll do it. But I knew I didn't know enough. Now, I had just read a wonderful book called The Sound of the City, written by a wonderful man called Charlie Gillett. And I knew that that book contained in it everything I needed to tell the story of pop. But I didn't know Charlie Gillett or how to go. But I mentioned my executive producer was Johnny Billing. And Johnny knew Charlie. And he fixed up for Charlie and I to have a drink with him. Charlie agreed to be the series consultant. And following that, we actually decided it would be best if we wrote the programmes together. It was, at that point, the most successful radio series the BBC ever exported. Went into over 70 territories. It enabled me to interview some of my musical heroes. It was a phenomenal experience, and it made my name.
An atmosphere or a mood which might be characterized as an awareness of the strange, that something's wrong, something's not quite right.
Whilst I was producing The Story of Pop, plans were being made for Capital Radio to be launched. And whilst I was working on The Story of Pop, I was invited to the old Root showroom in Piccadilly, where Capital were assembling their plans. And I met Michael Bucht and I met John Whitney and Aidan Day, who I knew because he'd been at the BBC. And they said, "You are the man we want. Come and help us set up Capital Radio." And I was sorely tempted, but I knew that if I walked out in the middle of producing a 26-part series for the BBC, I probably would never work again. So I declined and said, I have to continue and finish this series. So I finished The Story of Pop. BBC set me up on a road to senior management, and I was put on attachments and all the various things that happened. After that, I came back and I launched a new series with DLT called It's DLT OK.
Hi there, Radio 1 listeners. We're the Bay City Rollers.
Johnny Walker's lunchtime producer was a man called Ron Belcher, and he took 2 weeks off. And so I was producing Johnny for him, and it was the Bay City Rollers were at their peak at this time. And whenever I put the Bay City Rollers into the playlist, Johnny refused to play it and would put something else in. And we had the most incredible friendly discussions, but I could not get him to see at all. Johnny had decided that he was going to be perceived as a man who did not do what was expected of him. And that worked for Johnny, but it frustrated me, and I got pressure from above as to why I wasn't able to create the right kind of programme mix that was required, meeting all needs of the popular music spectrum at that time. But then I was invited to lunch by a man called Peter James, who had also worked at Radio 1. We got to the end of the lunch and he said, "You know, why don't we just have a brandy before we go?" And I thought, well, that was very nice. He said, "It'd be good to have a brandy." He said, "Because Aidan Day wants to come and join us for lunch and he's been a bit delayed." So it must have been 3 or 5:30 by the time Aidan turned up. And he said, "Tim," he said, "it's time for you to stop mucking about. You've got to come and play with the big boys. Come out into the real world. Join Capital Radio." And he took me back to Capital Radio, where I again met the managing director, and they made me an offer which I couldn't accept because it was the same money as I was earning at the BBC. And I said, "But you want me to walk away from the job security to an unknown? Nobody knows whether commercial radio is going to work. I'm going to lose my pension rights. I've got 2 young kids by that time. It doesn't make any sense." I wrote a letter back to John Whitney after that meeting and said, "You know, thrilled to have been offered the job, but from the salary you're offering, it's quite clear that you're not expecting me to make the kind of commitment that I would want to make." So the next thing, I got a phone call back saying, "Very clever, very clever. We will offer you a company car as well as the same salary." And that did it. And so I gave my 3-month notice to the BBC. The next day I was in the studio, Made of L4, producing a band. I can't remember who it was. When you're weary. And the phone rang and it was Derek Chinnery. He said, "Look," he said, "don't shoot the messenger. But," he said, "as you're going to them, BBC policy is that if you leave the BBC and go to a commercial broadcaster, you have to leave the building straight away." So I ended up with 2 salaries for 3 months. The second point to be made is, of course, to highlight the difference in those days between commercial radio and the BBC. There was no radio industry as we know today. There was them and us. And having been told that I had to vacate my office by the end of that week, I was really terrified. I thought, what have I done? I'm going into the great unknown. I could be out of work in 6 months if it all folds. I was just after they'd changed their music policy, because the initial policy, which was sort of like Joni Mitchell and Sergio Mendes and the Carpenters and very lovely stuff, it was almost the entire A&M and Warner Brothers catalogues, you know, that very soft, easy listening American stuff, hadn't worked at all. They changed it, and I was brought in really to put that all into action. One thing I'll never forget is soon after I got into Capital, within a few hours, the managing director said, "I think it would be a good idea, Tim, if you went round the country and saw some of the people working for some of the other commercial radio stations, you know, go to Piccadilly in Manchester, go to Clyde in Glasgow." And he said, "Go to 5 or 6 of them across a week, take next week off and do it. It'll be an education for you." And this is where I started to learn about commercial radio, because I went into Aidan's office, who was the controller at that point. I was his head of music. And I said to Aidan, I said, who organises transport round here? And he threw a copy of the Yellow Pages at me. Because I'd come from an organisation where if you had a personal problem, there was an HR department. If you wanted to go somewhere, there was a transport department. If you wanted your desk moved, there was a furniture moving department. And now I was in commercial radio, where I was obviously expected to organise my own transport. The most impressive person I met on my trip around the country was Jimmy Gordon at Radio Clyde. I went from there down to Piccadilly in Manchester, where I met Colin Walters for the very first time. I went from there down to Beacon Radio. And somebody had told me that Beacon Radio is run by two guys who are known as the truck drivers. But one of them at least was American. They may both have been American. Jay Oliver and Alan McKenzie. Well, these guys were impressive. They were out of a Hollywood movie. And here they were running or trying to run an American radio station in Wolverhampton. Doesn't compute somehow or other. By this point, of course, I'm beginning to think, what have I got myself into? Because these are people from all around the world who quite clearly know what they're doing. What do I know? I know about putting records in order. I know about briefing disc jockeys. I have no idea how you run a radio station. But my God, I learnt fast. By the time I got to Capital and got my feet under the table, as it were, I was instantly struck by the afternoon jock, who was a guy called Roger Scott, who I came to love. And in fact, organised his funeral and his memorial service at Abbey Road. Roger, to me, was the epitome of what a disc jockey should be.
Right, our final top 10 of the week will be tomorrow at 5 o'clock. And if you'd like to put in a call for your favourite song and thereby influence tomorrow's Hitline Top 10, all I need to know from you is what your favourite song is. No life history, no nothing.
He understood totally that what makes it work is if you devote yourself to creating the perfect context in which the music can be delivered. And that was what Roger did par excellence. I've said to several interviewers, when they ask me about my favourite broadcasters, I say my favourite two DJs were Alan Freeman and Roger Scott, and both for the same reason. Neither of them ever told you anything about themselves. Both of them concentrated on selling the music to you, of giving you the signposts that would ensure that even if you'd never heard this track, if you'd never heard of this artist, they made you believe it was going to be worthwhile you giving your time to the next 3.5 minutes for the track they had chosen to play. So Roger and I became very close. That's not to say we didn't have frustrations. I remember when that double album, was it called The River, came out by Bruce Springsteen. Roger said he got a copy and he started playing tracks on his afternoon show. And one track, two track, I thought was fine. By the time he'd played track number 5, I had to go into the studio and say, Roger, there are an awful lot of people who don't like Bruce Springsteen. I really think we ought to try and curb that a bit. Well, he wasn't too thrilled about that. He was considerably embarrassed the next time I went into the studio, because I used to have a golden rule that you don't go and interrupt a jock on air. I was sitting in my office in Capital when the phone rang, and it was the boss of MPL, Paul McCartney's organisation. And there were a few expletives came down the phone. There were considerable threats of legal action that was going to be taken against the station and certainly against me personally and certainly against Roger Scott. What had happened was that Roger had played an acetate of a track that Paul McCartney had only recorded the previous evening. It wasn't released. It was not registered with PPL. There was no possible legal way in which we could have broadcast that record. I go to the studio. Roger, where the did you get that track from? It landed on my desk. I said, well, who was it from? What did the label say? Oh, there was nothing in there. Well, what kind of envelope? What was the postmark? There was no postmark. It was just a plain brown envelope. Have you any idea who sent it to you? No. What made you think it was all right to play it? Well, I thought if somebody sent it to me, it must be all right to play it. We never, ever resolved that. Another thing about Roger, we never really resolved his problems about personal appearance. I remember we used to every year have an open-top bus to take part in the Lord Mayor's parade through the City of London. Roger would never go and stand on the top of the open deck and wave to the listeners. He always believed there were much more important things he could be doing with his time. And it was interesting because when I went to Capital, I brought a few people with me from Radio 1. Alan Freeman came over. joined us at Capital. John Pidgeon, writer and producer. Charlie Gillett, who came over from Radio 1 with me and worked. And then perhaps most significantly of all, my researcher at Radio 1 had been a guy called Mike Smith. And I brought Mike Smith in, and within 18 months, 2 years, I put him on The Breakfast Show. And he delivered the biggest breakfast show that Capital's ever had in London. I mean, I've ever had. And in 1981, Mike's half hour from 7:30 till 8 was delivering 1.2 million listeners. So it was a phenomenal era where we really hit the peak of listening in London. Our share actually for the first time exceeded that of Radio 1. Now, admittedly, Radio 1 weren't broadcasting for 24 hours at that time, so it's a bit unfair. And also the figure is now meaningless because there was no other competition. It was us or Radio 1 if you were into contemporary music listening. But it was an exciting time. I think my attitude to broadcasters has always been to be a big brother rather than a friend, I think. There were very few broadcasters that I ever felt were mates. I always kept a distance. People see me as, I think, a fairly formal character. And I am, I mean, I have a great sense of humour. I mean, I love writing gags. I'm very straight. I do gravitas better than falling about. And so I've always been that kind of elder brother and occasionally headmaster. I have never believed in giving people a real bollocking. I have a couple of times. But normally when somebody has been so outrageous that I've simply emotionally lost it. So that's been it, really. I've always believed that we talk man to man or man to woman in a very grown-up way. And I would always try and explain why, when going through a cassette, as it used to be, of somebody's broadcast, I would go through and say, now, did it not occur to you that if you'd done that before that, your punchline would have been a whole lot better? You know, but to work, not in a criticising way, but to say, let us analyse and see how together we can ensure that tomorrow's show is even more exciting.
And as we reach the top 10 on the number one chart with the number one coffee the network and Nescafe, Milli Vanilli are up a massive 18 places to this week's number 10.
Well, I first met Alan Freeman in 1967 when I joined Radio 1. But I didn't really get to know him until 1973 when I was offered the chance to do The Story of Pop. And the first question I was asked was, who do you want to present the programme? And I think we put three names forward and debated them. But in the end, I came to the conclusion that Alan was the only one, because of his longevity and because of the gravitas in his voice, would be able to deliver what was essentially going to be a factual, informative, educative programme, would have the credibility for listeners to say, yes, this man has a right to tell me these things.
Quote, pop music is the most powerful single tool with which Satan communicates his evil message.
And that was how I really got to know Alan. Every Wednesday, we used to go into a recording studio for 8 hours to make those programmes, because they were quite complicated in the layers of sound and the way we did it. And it was the first programme I'd ever produced in stereo. And Alan was fantastic. He would bring a typewriter into the studio, because we would have to rehearse a whole sequence, and there would be nothing for him to do. And while we were rehearsing, before it was time for a take, he would just type letters to his fans in the studio. So Alan typed all day for 8 hours, stopping every now and then. And we used to record those one-hour programmes in 3 or 4 minute sequences. A studio manager operating the 3 or 4 tape machines, another studio manager operating the 4 grams, a third studio manager doing the balance, me and a production secretary doing all the timings. So it was quite a complex little production. I mean, now, working with the likes of Pro Tools or Sadie, you can do it all on your own. But Alan's friendship came out of that, and subsequently, when he was given an afternoon show called Youth Club Call, he asked if I could produce him on that, and I did. Then, when I left Radio 1, he was fired from the rock show. They don't talk about that a lot. He says he left. I mean, in fact, Derek Chinnery fired Alan Freeman at that point.
It would take at least 24 hours of solid transmission to gather our last 5 years together and even hope to represent them in our final 3 hours. And today's music is chosen by you, the Saturday music lover, and the Giants on Album.
I interviewed Derek Chinnery about this a couple of years ago. Sadly, Derek no longer with us, but I interviewed Derek a couple of years ago, and he said, well, I felt at the time that it was wrong that we should devote a peak time like a Saturday afternoon to what was essentially a specialist music programme, rock music. This was a programme that had won every conceivable award around the world for the presentation of a rock show. Alan left. I rang him up for lunch as soon as I heard and said, why don't you come over and... Initially, you could sit in for Nicky Horn when he does his holiday, and then we'd take something on from that. And Alan stayed right the way through the time I was at Capital and beyond. After I left Capital, I got a phone call from Alan, and he said, it's really difficult. He said, I'm missing our conversations. I said, well, you've got my phone number, as you've just demonstrated. I said, you ring me any time you want. He said, yes, he said, but that's not fair. He said, you're not being paid anymore. I said, well, I don't care about that. I said, we're mates, you want to talk about something? I'm happy to talk. He said, well, I'm going to think about it. He rang me the next day. He said, I've sorted it out. I said, what's that? He said, you're going to be my manager. I said, Alice, I'm a radio producer, writer. I said, I don't know anything about managing artists. He said, you don't need to know anything. He said, all that happens, he said, people will ask me to do things and you decide whether I do them or not. I said, well, that doesn't sound too difficult. He said, there is one difficult thing that you'll have to do. I said, what's that? He said, when the time comes, he said, you will have to tell me that it's time to stop. And so from that day, which would have been at some point in 1983, through until his death in 2006, I looked after all of Alan's professional activities and quite a lot of his private life activities as well, including organising his funeral and the service that went with it. It was an incredible guy. We never had a contract, and his prediction about having to tell him when to stop came true, because there was a point when, after moving, we did go from Capital to Radio 1, back to Capital, then to Radio 2, where he ended his days, as it were. And there was a point where doing the Pick of the Pops look back shows for Radio 2, we were having to edit more than we had been doing. I had a word with Alan and I said, I think the time has come for you to stop doing Pick of the Pops.
And there it was, Gabrielle, February 2000 and the one called Rise, the number one, OK? And incidentally, our thanks to studio manager Martin Parker and producer Philip Swern. And don't forget, Pick of the Pops is a unique broadcasting production for Radio 2. So let's run down those final 10 number ones, all right?
But I said, I've got an idea. I'd come up with the title of their greatest bits, which I thought would enable us to play his favourite arias from the world of opera he loved and the odd overture or two. And in fact, after Pick of the Pops ended, we did, I think, 12 series of their greatest bits for Radio 2, until eventually Alan couldn't handle that either, because he'd had a major infection in his jaw and had had most of the left side of his jaw replaced with metal plates. And he didn't sound at the microphone as his audience had got used to him sounding. And so, again, we had another conversation, and regretfully, he agreed it was time to stop. And he didn't work again, I think, for another 2 or 3 years until he died. And that was a very sad 2 or 3 years, because almost every time I'd chat to him, he said, do you think we could get back on air? And I'd say, well, it all depends what happens to your jaw, Alan. You know, we just have to see how that comes along, you know. And it never got better. And sadly, he eventually died. He was essentially one of the shyest men it's ever been my privilege to meet. I'm lucky, I've worked with all the great names of the DJs of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And many of them are what I would call desperately shy people. I mean, I would certainly say Alan Freeman, Emperor Roscoe, Kenny Everett, Roger Scott, and more. Very essentially shy men who were able to invent this world around the microphone in which they could have a private relationship with the listener. And that was the world where they felt comfortable. That was the world where they could give of their best. And that was what Alan was, essentially. He was a frighteningly generous man. The number of times I had to rebuke him for giving somebody a check just because they told him a hard luck story. He would go out of his way to help anybody. The number of charity gigs he did, even when he was absolutely knackered, was phenomenal. Whether it was for the London Association of Youth Clubs or any of the great charities who were forever asking him to join in. His relationship with me and my family was superb. He would quite often come for Sunday lunch when we lived near him. We lived in Camden Town, he lived in Maida Vale. And Sunday lunches were an especial joy. After lunch, he would get up and sit at the piano and pretend he was playing piano in the cocktail bar of the Dorchester. wonderful, gentle touch at the keyboard. Sometimes he'd go off into his favourite classical pieces. I mean, he'd started life wanting to be an opera singer, and classical music was his first love, especially that bit of it in the world of opera. I often think that that's why he loved heavy metal, because the concept of show, of pomp, matched his initial learning from the world of opera. He was terrified of confrontation. I mean, when Derek Chinnery told him he was coming off his beloved rock show, his attitude was not to be angry, not to fight. It was to, well, it lasted, you know, it was good while it was there. If that's the way it is, that's the way it is. Then he'd get home that night and think, I'm really angry, I'm going to resign. I saw him many times unable to deal with conflict. I remember one occasion, I got a phone call from the technical operations manager in Broadcasting House and said, Alan's turned up for his rehearsal. This was for the tea time programme. And he won't go into the studio. He's sitting on a windowsill in the corridor outside, cursing the world. Oh, God, I'll come over. So I went over, and what had happened was, because the studios ran continuously, every show, back to back, but when one was not being used, it would be pre-recording programmes for other occasions. So they were all in use all the time. And it turned out that Paul Burnett had turned up late for his World Service programme and was overrunning into Alan's rehearsal time for his programme. And Alan was doing the Big Moody. So I got over to Broadcasting House, because our offices were in Egton House, studios, Broadcasting House. Bizarre. I went over, there he was, sitting in the windowsill. So I say, move along. Sat down in the windowsill next to him. Well, I said, this is a rum job. What's gone wrong? Bloody Burnett was overrunning there. I need my suit. I can't do it. I'm not going on. A protest has got to be made. I said, well, that's absolutely right. I said, it's terrible behaviour, you know. I said, but it's happened, hasn't it? And there's not a lot we can do now. I said, you know what the real problem is? I said, when you don't go on, the listeners aren't going to know that Paul Burnett overran his recording in your studio. They're just going to say, what's the matter with Alan Freeman that he can't be bothered to come on air? Do you think that's what they'll think? I said, oh, I don't see what else they're going to think. They're going to say, where is Alan Freeman? It can only backfire on you. You know, I said, I think you should go in, do it. And I said, then afterwards, together, we'll make the protest about Paul's overrunning. How's about that? Okay, but it's always me that gets picked on. You know, and so it was that kind of relationship. And I have to say that I think over the years, what is now euphemistically called talent management is one of the things, if you're going to succeed as a background boy, as a manager, talent management is one of the most challenging areas in which you work. And it doesn't just mean talent, staff management. When I retired from the staff at Unique Broadcasting, Simon Cole, the chief executive, said to me, well, you must continue to be associated with the company. What do you want to do? And I said, I'm happy to do anything that helps the company, providing I do not get involved in personnel matters with staff. I've cried enough, I've ached enough, I've suffered enough because of problems dealing with, you know, recalcitrant staff. After Capital Radio, I went into a period a bit like the doldrums, really. I'd had about 18 months where I didn't know what I was doing. I told the world that I was a freelance producer. I was managing Richard Allinson. I was doing some work at one point looking after Noel Edmonds' public appearances and doing some things with Mike Smith. But I wasn't making very many radio programmes. But then I was asked to be a judge in the Sony Awards. It was the first awards for the year 1983, and it was the awards ceremony in the spring of 84. And I had been judging what was then called the classical music category. The winning programme was a programme called Mr. Halle's Band, which was the story of the Halle Orchestra in Manchester. And at the reception, which was in the Hilton, Park Lane, I asked Colin Walters if I could meet the producer of the winning programme. And that was the first time I met a young man called Simon Cole, who'd been head of programmes at Piccadilly when I was head of programmes at Capital. And we got on like a house on fire. We stayed in touch over those 2 years, but 2 years later, Simon said, I've got £50,000 from Piccadilly Radio to experiment with independent production. Everybody says you're the best programmer around. Will you come and be director of programmes and develop our programme ideas? I thought about it, and I said, well, I've already got quite a lot of commitments now, but I could do a part-time consultant programme director. And we developed a range of programmes, a Friday night phone-in show called Rockline, where we went to artists all around the world and people would call in and ask them questions. We did a concert series. So we developed a range of programmes like these, quite a lot of specials whenever big American artists. And then in 1989, Piccadilly Radio was sold. And we didn't like, when we met him, the man who had bought Piccadilly Radio. Owen Oyston was his name. We gave our notice. And after a conversation in a hotel bar in Russell Square, we decided the only thing to do was to start again, only this time we would own it. And that was the birth of Unique Broadcasting. And the challenge for Unique was, of course, that we had to be inventing programmes that we thought radio stations would be prepared to broadcast. Simon had worked out that the only way to do this was for him to find sponsors who would attach their names and therefore effectively pay for the production of the programmes with a bit of surplus on the top that would ensure some of the sponsorship revenue could also go to the station. So they were on a win-win. They got a free programme that they could never have afforded to make themselves, and they got a contribution to their advertising revenue. And that worked extremely well, and it ran through for many, many years. In 1992, David Hatch, the managing director of BBC Radio, was worried that he was going to be forced to accept the 25% quota that television had been given. David wanted to prove that this wouldn't work, so he allocated £500,000 to be allocated across the networks to experiment with independent radio. Now, we were one of, I think at that point, only three companies that were in a position to make radio for the BBC. The other two were principally audio producers. We were the only one making programmes for radio because we were the only people doing commercial radio programmes. We started making programmes for Radio 2. And by the time I stepped down in 2004, we were the preeminent production company in the UK, producing for all five BBC networks and BBC World, as well as our commercial radio activities, which continue.
Willie Hightower bringing us to the end of another edition of Sound of the 60s, compiled and directed by Phil the Collector Swern, as a Unique production for Radio 2.
Well, I'm not one of those who throws his hands in the air and says it isn't like it was when I was a young man, because quite clearly it isn't like it was when I was a young man. And my God, if it was like it was when I was a young man, we'd be in real trouble. I'm excited by the expansion of platforms. I'm excited by an awful lot of the technological things that are happening to it. If I have any negative points to make at all about my feelings about radio, it is that I feel that commercial radio has let its standards drop a bit in terms of its now obsession with narrowness. I feel that most of my listening to commercial radio delivers me what I regard as quite shallow broadcasting compared with what once was. I don't see anything clever in a 45-minute non-stop music sweep. I think radio should step one bit beyond the idea of a compilation CD or a playlist that you download. I mean, I think, to me, radio has to offer added value. And I think that, in fact, the fact that commercial radio has, by and large, let that idea of added value slip is going to be a problem for them. Because a lot of the online providers have spotted that the listener enjoys listening to music in a context. And therefore, when you see British and American online providers wanting to create an environment in which they deliver their music, an image, then I think that the commercial radio stations are going to have to step up some of their activities. Now, that's not to say there aren't interesting things that are happening. I mean, I think sport radio is doing extremely well in showing how to really make radio. I like a lot of the things that are happening on Classic FM. I like a lot of the things that are happening on LBC. As I drive around the country, which I still do, I listen to a lot of radio that I have to say I regard as shallow and disposable. And that saddens me. I have always been able, I've been lucky, I suppose, to work in making radio that had depth, that really did involve the listener, that really did draw them in, that really did involve the creation of a one-on-one relationship. I can't help but feel that on too many radio stations, that's been let go. I've got grandchildren at university now, so it's interesting to know what they think, and I talk to them. I can tell you they have not one second's interest in anything that I have done. My attempt at any point to explain what radio once was is of no consequence to them whatsoever. They assure me that they love me dearly, but as for what radio used to be, they couldn't give a toss, and my God, they're right. because what happens now will be their world. It will be their creation. What I made, what I did, was absolutely spot on for the time. We broke barriers, we did new things. It's astounding to think that old men like me in our 60s, 70s and 80s actually changed the world of broadcast communication.
Thank you.